Take out your outlines and say pride across the top of them. Open your Bibles to Luke chapter 9. We're going to be starting in verse 18 this morning. Can you give me the first slide? Can the booth give me the first slide in my presentation? I can't get there on my own. So, that's just great. Thank you for that. We are going to be in Luke chapter 9, verses 18 through 27. I'll give you a second. Love to hear those pages flipping. We'll also have it up on the screen this morning. Now it happened that as he was praying alone, the disciples were with him. And he asked them, "Who do the crowd say that I am?" And they answered, "John the Baptist, but others say Elijah, and others that one of the prophets of old has risen." You might remember that's what Herod said. So what do we get? We just kind of get what the public opinion of Jesus Christ is. Then he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter, who spoke for the disciples oftentimes, is kind of representative of them. Peter answered, "The Christ of God." And he strictly charged and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised." And he said to all, now he's speaking to the crowd, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. But I tell you truly, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God." Luke chapter 9, verses 18 to 27. First thing I want to do, of course, as I often do, is try to locate us a little bit. So if you've got the back of your outline, you can turn to the back of the outline and see a map that is probably so small you can barely read it. But what we've got down in the southern section is Capernaum, right? That's where Jesus and Peter kind of been. Peter's lived there most of his life. Jesus has taken up residence there as well. Bethsaida, the home of Philip and Andrew and I think James and John and a whole bunch of guys, they live in Bethsaida. And that's because Bethsaida is one of the primary areas for fishing. And then up in the north is Caesarea Philippi. Now, you'll remember Caesarea Philippi from last week. That's the place that they were headed. And that's actually the place where this story occurs. We know that from the book of Matthew. Now, this map that's up on the screen has got a little bit more depth to it. And so it kind of gives you the idea that the water is down at the low point. And if you look all the way up in the north towards where Caesarea Philippi is, there's a gobbledygook of words because it goes over the top of a thank you in the booth for that. It goes over the top of some mountains. And so the thing I want to point out, two things. One, what you see there, the Jordan River, that's going right through the middle of things. And two, I want you to see that gobbledygook up there is Mount Hermon. Some of you have heard of Mount Hermon. That is the snow-cap area in Israel. It is way up there in the north above Galilee. You can see it from the Golan Heights, which would be off to the right. And you can also see it up to the north. And you obviously can see it from Caesarea Philippi, because from Mount Hermon comes the water that feeds down and contributes to the Jordan River, Galilee, and all of that. Remember, up in the north, where Caesarea Philippi is where they were worshiping Pan. This is a huge area of pagan worship. And that pagan worship, this is the ruins of that today. That pagan area, at the base of Mount Hermon, there are just this huge outcropping of rock that comes out from it, which is where all of the city is built. Caesarea Philippi was built. And there are these large, huge, flat areas of just bedrock that were flattened out long ago by just natural means. But these outcroppings of rock are so bizarre looking. They're so unusual that they were a place of pagan worship. And that cave that you see off there to the left is the cave of Pan, where all of the water that was flowing out of Mount Hermon from natural springs and all the water that it fed would flow out and then down eventually into the Jordan River. So all of this is the location that this story is happening in. I know some of that is like, why are you telling us about this? This will all come together at the end, okay? So just kind of store some of that geographic information, store some of that detail information away, because it's going to come up as we proceed forward. Now, let's go back to the text, Luke chapter 9, verse 18. Now, it happened that as he was praying alone, the disciples were with him. I grayed out the rest of those verses because we'll come to those next. But for now, I just want to focus on this. As it happened, as he was praying alone, the disciples were with him. We're going to see this scene a few times in the scriptures where Jesus is praying and his disciples are there. The disciples generally, when they're there with Jesus, are not also praying. It just says they're hanging out with each other while Jesus prayed. Jesus spent a tremendous amount of time praying. But what we see in the book of Luke is this: prayer often precedes true spiritual breakthrough, not only in the life of Jesus, but also in the lives of those that are around him. Don't miss this, because the book of Luke emphasizes, whenever you see Jesus praying in the book of Luke, something is about to happen. Some spiritual breakthrough is about to occur. That should be a lesson to us. We all probably desire spiritual breakthrough. We all desire to see God at work in our lives. We desire to have that kind of focus. But how many of us walk out of church on Sunday, set down our Bibles, and then find our Bibles in the exact same place when we come back next week? We have forgotten the things of God that we were talking about on Sunday. We kind of get a little bit of a reminder at growth group, but how easy is it to walk out and just not do anything with it? Prayer keeps us connected to God, and God connected to us. It's dependency. And any time that we see spiritual breakthrough happen, it's coming from a time of prayer in the life of Jesus Christ. If Jesus Christ had to pray and had to be dependent on God, how much more you and I? Prayer always precedes spiritual breakthrough. Back to the text. And he asked them, "Who do the crowds say that I am?" They answered, "John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. Others that one of the prophets of old has arisen." And then he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered, "The Christ of God." And then Jesus does that curious thing, doesn't he? He strictly charged, it's imperative on top of imperative. He strictly charged them, commanded them to tell this to no one. The question is timeless. Who do you think I am? Yeah, there's a cultural opinion of who God is. There's a cultural opinion of who Jesus is. There's maybe even one that exists in Hollywood that gets more pronouncement than others, because we live close to there and we watch a lot of those TV shows. And so we get to experience that part of our culture. And then kind of the news media, they have a different opinion of who Jesus is. And they find the most interesting people to interview to reveal who Jesus is. And that gets kind of broadcast to us. Some of you listen to talk radio, and there's a whole nother set of opinions of who Jesus is. You can go talk to the person down at the corner bakery at your local coffee shop, at the donut shop, and you'll find out a whole different version of who Jesus is. I was just looking through the most popular books that are on Amazon, and several of the books that are in the top 10 in the religious section are about who God is. Who God is from a Buddhist perspective, who God is from a Hindu perspective, who God is from a Christian perspective. There's a couple of really good books on that. One by C.S. Lewis called Mere Christianity that is absolutely phenomenal. And then there's one book that's in there. You might have heard of this. I think. Do I remember the author? I don't want to miss. I'd probably say the wrong guy. But there was one in there. How to be spiritual without having to go to church. That's awesome. How to be spiritual without going to church. Like how to, you know, have a relationship with God and not have Jesus. It's just stupid, that kind of thing. But this is in the top 10. It's a huge cultural question that we live in. And Jesus's question is, he's interested. He wants to know what the culture thinks about Jesus. Sometimes that's significant and important. But what he really asks us is, who do you think I am? And I would ask, what's your answer? What is your answer to that question? Today is Communion Sunday. It's the first Sunday of the month. We always want to start off our month by really setting aside some time for communion, to remember Jesus. And this is the question in the text that we have today. Who do you think Jesus is? The disciples provide an answer to Jesus, and that answer comes from Simon Peter. It's even more clear in the book of Matthew. Matthew 16:16 through 19 says, Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Now, that's a very, very dramatic answer. I mean, that just hits you right between the eyes when you're reading the book of Matthew. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Christ was not Jesus' last name. Christ was actually means anointed one. The anointed one. It was the anointed one of the Old Testament. The one that would be Messiah. Christ actually means Messiah. The anointed one of God. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona," or Barjona. That bar means son of, and Jonah means that his dad's name was Jonah. So Barjona, you are Simon, son of Jonah. "For flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter." Now, this is not really a renaming. This is just taking one name in Greek and one name in Aramaic, and he's just kind of playing with words here. But he's taking that name, Peter, and he's Peter, which in the original language means rock. And he's saying, "You are Peter, and on this rock," and so this gets confusing, doesn't it? Is it like the guy? Or is it where they're standing? I would probably venture to guess that it's a bit of both. Jesus stands, it says in the text, in Caesarea Philippi, this place that has these unusually large outcroppings of rock, in a place of pagan worship all around this area at the base of Mount Hermon. And as he hears for the very first time his disciples say, "We believe that you are the Christ. We've talked about it and we get it. And you're the Christ. You're the anointed one." That's what you've been trying to say, isn't it? And Jesus responds with, "Flesh and blood did not reveal this to you. My Father in heaven has revealed this to you. And on this rock," on that pronouncement that you've made, Peter, "on this rock, I will build my church." On this rock, Peter, and on the disciples, which will be, by the way, part of the very foundation of heaven, the book of Revelation says, "On this rock, I will build my church. And the gates of hell," he goes on to say, "shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whoever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven." In other words, those that are bound to Jesus will be bound to him forever. "And whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Anything loosed from God will be loosed from him in eternity. "What you do in this world matters. And it is through God's church, the established church, which would be birthed through these disciples." And those disciples, with their mouthpiece, kind of their leader, being that guy Peter, it is on this foundation that Jesus is going to build his church. And as he stands in Caesarea Philippi, in a place that is, to this day, actually known for paganism, known for worshiping fickle, weird gods and very, 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 very satanic and in wicked ways, he says, "On this rock I will build my church." The very gates of hell, that was what the cave of Pan was called. It was the gates of hell. Like, there's so much imagery that is vivid in this place. The gates of hell, the gates of all paganism, all that exists that is against God will not stand against you clowns, you know, you 12 complete goofballs. It's an ironic statement. The disciples have just declared Jesus as the anointed one, the Christ, and then just to make sure that they don't, you know, screw this whole thing up, he says, and don't tell anybody. Don't say anything. Could you guys just keep your mouth shut for a little while? What we have here, though, is that Peter's confession indicates an increasing clarity, an increasing confidence. It's really, for Peter, it's a pride moment. He stands up and he's just like, I am delighted to express this. And he pours out the great pride that the disciples have. We are following the Christ. This is no simple rabbi. We are following the Christ, the anointed one of God. And then Jesus, what does he immediately say? This is not going to go the way that you think. Up to this point, he's been revealing himself, hasn't he? He's been revealing himself through miracles. He's been revealing himself through his words. He's been revealing himself in all these different ways. He is as far away from Jerusalem as we're going to get. Like, he has moved his way up north, 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 north. And then he says to his disciples, okay, you've understood that I am the Christ, and now I'm going to redefine for you what that means. In the text, by the time we get to verse 51 of this chapter, you will see Jesus turn and face Jerusalem and begin to walk that way. This is a pivotal moment. This is the turning of Jesus from being as far away from Jerusalem, far away in the north as he is. And he says, I'm going to build my church. And now he begins to head back toward Jerusalem. He strictly charges and commands them to tell nobody about their conversation. Jesus' secrecy command cautions against what I would call just enough knowledge to be dangerous. That's what the disciples have. They have just enough knowledge about who Jesus Christ is to actually be kind of dangerous to his mission. He wants to make sure that they understand what that means, that Christ is the anointed one, he affirms. However, there was a pervading belief during that time period about Messiah. This is what the Jews believed the Messiah was going to look like. This is completely what they believed. They believed that the Messiah, the anointed one, and by the way, for good reason, if you read the Old Testament and you built a picture of Messiah, I believe that you would come up with this answer as well. I don't think, like, there are certain things that God purposely revealed and did so in such a spaghetti kind of way. Everything is kind of wrapped together that it would be impossible to separate the first coming of Jesus from the second coming of Jesus. You just wouldn't be able to do it naturally. Only by God's revelation, only by God telling us can we separate out this victorious warrior type of picture from the Old Testament from the picture that Jesus is going to emphasize. The popular view. Remember when Jesus fed the 5,000? It said in the book of Matthew or Mark, I can't remember which one, maybe both, it said that Jesus went and hid himself because the crowds wanted to take him and make him king. This is what they were thinking. That guy's the Christ, and this is what he's going to do. He is going to come in, and he is going to dominate politically and militarily. The prevailing concept of the Anointed One was of military power and political dominance. Why? Because the Jews had no military, and they had no political influence. They were under the thumb of multiple layers of government. Not just of Rome, but even of Rome's kind of the governors that were over the area, the Herod and all of his family that were left over, that were in the Galilee, clear down to Israel region. They were buried. They were weak. They were powerless. And so they built a Messiah. They built a picture of Messiah from the Old Testament that was only partial. They didn't understand some of those texts. They didn't really understand what they meant. And so rather than try to just say, wow, this is a big picture and we're not totally sure, they would just kind of focus on this because they felt weak, because they were marginalized. We can be like that, can't we? We can be overwhelmed by our weakness and get obsessed with power. We can get obsessed with politics because we want to make a difference in this world. And Jesus steps into the disciples' lives, and he steps in really to all of the crowd that is around him, and he says, this is not what you are expecting. The Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, the scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. Whoever would save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. And probably the hinge pin statement. What does it profit a man if he gains the world, but he loses himself or his life or his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in glory and the glory of the Father and the holy angels. I tell you truly, there are some standing here, his little foreshadowing, who will not taste death until they have seen the kingdom of God. Jesus Christ makes the point that even though your concept of Christ is about military power and it's about political dominance, even though that's your view, I'm going to redefine who the Christ really is. I need to explain that to you. So your confession of Jesus as the Christ, Son of the living God, that has been revealed to you by my Father, and I am delighted in it, but please don't tell anybody because it's not what you think. And he goes on, and from this moment, you know, before this, he has said very little about his suffering. But now, he turns his face to Jerusalem. And he says, the Son of Man is going there, and he is going to get killed. These statements confused the disciples. We have the advantage of knowing the rest of the story, and we've heard it many, many times. And so, to us, we just go, how could you not understand that? Just remember, this all happens in real time and they are overwhelmed. I mean, you know, Peter is so excited about his confession and he's so swelling up with pride. I mean, he is just pumped about what has just gone on that I think many of these words just went right over their heads. They were just excited that this was the Christ. That was it. They could not separate in their minds the idea that Jesus, the Messiah, had come to suffer. That just didn't go together. A suffering Messiah? That was offensive. That just didn't make any sense. In fact, when Jesus Christ starts talking about this, what does Peter do? It says in the book of Matthew and Mark, it says that Peter took him aside. He takes Jesus aside and began to rebuke him. This is a great moment. He just said, you're the Son of the living God, and God says this whole, like, on this rock, I'm going to build my church. I mean, Peter must just be like, whoa, this is awesome. And then Jesus says, but I'm going to suffer. I got to go to Jerusalem. It's not going to be good. And Peter takes him aside. And he says, far be it from you, Lord. In other words, that is not going to happen to you. This shall never happen to you. But Jesus turns. Think about the proximity of these two stories, okay? like these happen right in a row. Jesus turns and says to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." He just said he was going to build the church on this rock. And now he's saying, "Get behind me, Satan." Peter must have just been dizzy. I mean, that just must have been one hey-ho of a set of exchanges for him. I think of it this way. That escalated awfully quick. Holy mackerel. All right, I'm going to get off of that really quick because I know some of you are going to email me. Okay. Look at what Jesus says in the parallel accounts of this story. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world, but he loses or he forfeits himself? In other words, you get all that you want in this world, but you have given up your soul. You have no relationship to God through Jesus. And then Peter goes right after that. He goes straight after what this world wants. He wants a Christ that is going to come in and pretty much kick butt, take names, and just, you know, reestablish Israel and get rid of the Gentiles, and all will be well again, and we're going to be dominant, and we're going to rule over everybody, and the way that we're going to bless the world is we're going to smash them, essentially. Satan sets his mind on the things of man. That's what Jesus says. He says, "Get behind me, Satan. You have not set your mind on the things of God. You've set them on the things of man." And I think these things ask us a profound set of questions. What is your hope in Jesus Christ? What do you believe about what is truly powerful in this world? Is it military might? Is it the crushing of all things that are around us that would provide us with that kind of influence and dominance and significance? I will land us at this. I believe that authentic hope in Christ commits to being just like Jesus. Weak, powerless, and almost appearing foolish by the world's standards. Will you choose this? That is so hard to do. Actually choose, despite your ability to do otherwise, to be weak, powerless, and foolish, to care for those that are weaker than you, that are more powerless than you, that are less wise than you, for Jesus' sake? Will you live a life of reconciling these things to a world that is drunk in its addiction to the other things? What Jesus reveals is a spiritual truth that not only exists at that time period for Jesus, it exists today also for us and for all that are authentic followers of Christ. That we do not attain influence and we do not attain power according to the world's standards. That is the devil in disguise. He may look like the most faithful of disciples, but put those things behind you. Satan sets his eyes on the things that are significant in this world. Jesus set his eyes on the things that are significant in heaven. And he details those when he says that I must go and suffer and experience the loss of everything for the sake of God, for the sake of all that God has planned. I'm going to go to the cross. And those that follow me, they've got to take up their cross, this picture of humiliation, of being stripped and just laid bare in front of everybody. They must take up their cross daily and follow me. I got to tell you, when Jesus is walking away from the cross in the book of Luke, a lot of people follow him. As Jesus walks back toward the cross in the book of Luke, he will eventually have nobody following him. It begins to thin the crowd. This kind of a message, it's not nearly as popular. This kind of a Christ, they just didn't have a category for it. I wonder in our own lives, I wonder in the midst of this text, are we praying for spiritual breakthrough, for spiritual truth in our lives? Because Jesus is asking you today, who do you think I am? Our answer to that question is significant. But Jesus holds up his hand and gives us the kind of, you know, shh. Don't speak it. Anyone who follows me is going to suffer and experience loss. Loss of the things to this world for the significance of the next. If you want to follow me, take up your cross daily. Live a life of weakness, powerlessness, and foolishness. In other words, choosing to bring out what is in others instead of yourself for the sake of the cross, for the sake of Jesus. Is it any wonder that as Jesus walks back through Galilee, everybody goes home? They don't want to follow a guy like that. And Jesus asked you this morning. And so what do you want to do? We have the opportunity to take all of our questions, our doubts, all that is maybe even wrestling through in our hearts right now to Jesus in our time of communion. I've asked John Carava, one of our church elders, to come and share and lead us in our time of communion. So, John, I'm going to...